Hello, viewers, readers, listeners, etc., to another episode of The Writer's Sheath. The second episode, to be exact. So we survived the first one, so that's always good. This is a fantasy-themed podcast where we discuss everything from existing book series and video game lore to writing tips and ideas for your own stories and games. We'll be going through things like my ideas and my thoughts for the creative process of writing, and basically anything fantasy is fair game. So I'm your host, David, as always, and to kick things off this week, we'll be continuing our series on fantasy, races, and creatures. So in this series, we're going to continue looking at some common tropes that we see in fantasy literature, as well as other sources, and more importantly, how do we make them fresh again? So we'll be looking at sort of where they came from, how they've changed over time, a couple of examples where we see them that are interesting, and some new ideas on how to keep them fresh. So, without further ado, I'd like to warn everybody that this topic is not for the faint of heart, so if you have any unresolved fear of reptiles, fire, or being eaten alive, strap yourselves in, because we're talking dragons this week on The Writer's Sheath. Honestly, what says fantasy more than a dragon? Some of the best villains and antagonists that we have in the most famous stories are dragons. They're sort of crafty and these mighty and terrifying beasts that are either selfish or greedy or hyper-intelligent. But also some of the most important allies and protagonists in stories are dragons. I'm thinking Atreyu from The Neverending Story, this sort of fluffy, floppy-eared dragon dog who's sort of this benevolent figure. I'm thinking Saphira from the Aragorn series, which is a great series where sort of dragon rider and dragon make these elaborate relationships together, and so they're very ambiguous characters. They're not exactly pigeonholed to one trope. But where do these great beasts come from? These magnificent animals, and how have they evolved in the fantasy genre over time? I'm no expert on literary history, but I read a lot of books and I play a lot of games, so you're gonna have to trust me on this one. So let's start off small. What exactly is a dragon? Perhaps you've been living under a rock and have no clue. In the most basic form, they are reptilian creatures or animals, usually of magic origin and power. They are winged, usually, although the arrangement of their limbs is a topic of hot debate amongst the nerd community. We will refer to this as the Limb Wars. We'll revisit this later. And of course, this applies to European dragons. So on the other side, we have Chinese and East Asian dragons, which are these sort of serpentine creatures, usually with only two legs, sometimes four. They have no wings. They are basically flying serpents that fly through magic rather than wings alone. Although it can be argued that dragons with wings also need to fly through magic because they are too heavy to be carried by the laws of the human and physical universe. But again, magic. You can hand wave and explain a lot with magic. But again, we'll revisit this soon. One thing that's common to a lot of dragons is a love and lust for treasure and gold. This is sort of a need to collect and contain a vast hoard of treasure. And this point will lead us to our first example of a dragon, which is a very old one, being Fafnir, the dragon of Norse mythology from the Volsung saga. So Fafnir is sort of this greedy and powerful dragon who guards a vast treasure hoard from all intruders, but he was once something very different from a dragon, according to this legend. He was a dwarf, actually, and he was the son of the dwarf king at that. Finding this sort of cursed gold and a ring, he is transformed by his greed into this terrible beast who sort of spews poison as he moves around his lair. And eventually he is killed by the hero Sigurd and put to rest. Basically, Sigurd digs a trench in Fafnir's cave, waits for the dragon to step over the trench to go to the stream to drink. Everybody got a drink. Water's good for you. Stay hydrated, folks. And then Sigurd plunges his sword into Fafnir's chest, eventually killing him. And before he dies, Fafnir actually warns Sigurd not to take all of his gold. This can be argued that perhaps he's just trying to protect his interests. But he warns Sigurd that all who collect the gold, the treasure hoard, are cursed, as he himself was. And so, right from this very early example of what a dragon is and how they come about, we see a very strong link between dwarf and dragon, which any of you are young fantasy enthusiasts yourself, you might recognize from a later tale, namely The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. I honestly don't think I can make it clear enough that every time we talk about fantasy, probably 80 to 95% of the time, we will be discussing one form of Tolkien's work or another, and that's okay because they are absolutely amazing. And so in this case, we have Smaug, or Smog, or however you'd like to say his name. I personally grew up saying Smog and was quite devastated when Bilbo in the movie said Smaug. It hurt a little bit, but that's okay, we're going to move on. So basically, we have this all-encompassing evil dragon who sits on a big pile of treasure that he stole from the dwarves. So again, the dwarves and dragons in this world are very linked. We are told at some point in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings that dragons have been a bane to the dwarves for many years. Most of the seven rings of the great dwarf lords made by Sauron were lost by being eaten by dragons. So their wearers were eaten by a dragon that was taking over their home and stealing their gold. And their rings were lost, which is good because, you know, you don't want the Dark Lord having all the rings, but that's okay. The main story for The Hobbit is that a group of dwarves are trying to retake their home because they are unsure if the dragon Smaug, who has been sleeping for many years, I think it's 60 years at the time of the adventure, they're unsure if he's awake or not, or if he's dead. They hope maybe he's died in their halls. And so they go on a quest recruiting Bilbo to be their burglar. As a hobbit, he is very quiet. So they recruit him to sort of burgle their treasure. More importantly, there is one specific piece of treasure, the Arkenstone, that sort of is like the jewel that the king, that represents the dwarf king. And so they want that back. But also they just want their home and all their gold back. But of course, if they got there and the dragon was slain, that would be too easy. So they do get there, and Smaug has awakened. And so the large part of the end of the novel is sort of Bilbo attempting to steal from the dragon's treasure pile, and sort of negotiating how to evade this dragon, how to sort of appease him, and how to survive his encounter with him. Bilbo goes through a lengthy conversation with the dragon, in which he tries to convince it to let him go by complimenting it, by stalling for time while he's looking for this treasure. And the dragon is very appreciative of all of the schmoozing. Although he's aware that he's being played, he can't help it when Bilbo plays on his ego. So here we see a very proud dragon, one who can't resist the temptation of letting people compliment him. He keeps Bilbo around just because he likes to hear him talk. Dragons love riddles, so when Bilbo starts to spew out all the nicknames that he's given himself throughout this adventure, things like Barrel Rider, like Luck Wearer, and things like that, the dragon is entranced by these riddles. Although he knows that Bilbo is a thief and a liar, he still can't help himself. Another thing we see is that the dragon has the magic ability to sort of make you do his will. As he's speaking to Bilbo, Bilbo is very aware that there is something invading his mind, trying to bend him to the dragon's will. He has to try very hard. He has to make a conscious effort to resist the dragon's, basically its rhetoric. Just through speaking, it is able to sort of convince its listeners to do its will. Another obvious sign of Smaug's greed that we see in The Hobbit is that Bilbo originally sneaks into his lair. He manages to steal one small artifact to prove to the rest of the dwarves, to the rest of his company, that the gold is there and that he is able to steal from it. And when he returns, Smaug is extremely aware immediately that something has been stolen. He knows that one piece, a small cup or a goblet, I think it is, from his vast hoard, his vast thing that covers the entire dwarven city of Erebor, a city full of gold, and he knows that this one artifact was taken. So again, this plays on the hyper-intelligent and mystical nature of dragons. They're beyond humanity. They're very hard to understand. And another thing that is mentioned in The Hobbit is that Smaug is actually one of the smaller dragons on Middle-earth, and he's very large. Like he is a terrifying beast, but it's mentioned that others much bigger than him were existent in the past of Middle-earth. So we get the idea that dragons are larger than life. They are terrifying. They are a calamity. When they attack somewhere, when they approach, it's like a natural disaster. It's like the coming of the end times for the people that live there. And that is very much a sense we get from the dwarves when they recount the story of the day Erebor was attacked. Like it was a hurricane coming just as he flew by. And so having looked at a very classic example of a dragon through Smaug and sort of through Fafnir, we'll move on to a different interpretation of the dragons. One that sort of plays on that same idea in The Hobbit of dragons as bringers of destruction and doom. And we see this example in the game Guild Wars 2. It's been out for a few years. It is an ongoing game. The story is not yet completed. But in Guild Wars, we see the main antagonist of the game. We see the Elder Dragons, which are sort of these primordial, possibly as old as the world itself, dragons that are seen as these forces of nature. These dragons, each themselves, have their own personalities, but they seem to be more focused on hunger, sort of very 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 literal, very mundane driving forces. They are hungry. They need to consume to stay alive. When they wake up, they just begin eating and destroying the world. And so, at the beginning of the game, spoilers possibly ahead, the main characters think that these dragons are evil, that they need to be stopped. But once they start to kill off some of these dragons, they realize that the other dragons that are remaining, just begin to get stronger, and that they have actually upset some of the natural cycles in the world by destroying these dragons. So these dragons are forces of nature. They are larger than mountains themselves, and they are described as more powerful than even the gods of Tyria. Tyria being the land that Guild Wars takes place in, mostly. And so you have these Elder Dragons. Their spheres, sort of their different areas of influence, are fire, ice, water, death, plants, and crystal. So there are six Elder Dragons. And these are not very normal. I mean, fire and ice and water, those are sort of normal, common, areas of influence for a dragon to control. But the other ones are very unique, and so you get the idea that dragons don't necessarily have to be that red, fire-breathing dragon that you get from The Hobbit. Even Fafnir, an older example, he is a poison-breathing dragon. There's no sense of him breathing fire. But again, these dragons are also intimately tied to the magic in the world. They wake up whenever the magic in the world, the ambient magic, the sort of magic that pervades the universe, gets too high. And in their awakening, when they wake up, they begin to consume. And by the time they're done consuming, they go back to sleep, and the ambient magic of the world has lowered significantly. And then it begins to rise again as they sleep. So they are intimately tied to the sort of the health and the cycles of the world. And so by destroying them, you actually disrupt the natural processes. And so they bring up a big dilemma of, when they wake up, they kill everything. So we need to find a way to survive that doesn't involve killing them. And that's sort of the active problem that they are dealing with in the story of Guild Wars 2 right now. Now, for some reason, and I'm not 100% sure why, although it can be said that there are many elitists within the nerd community. For some reason, people are utterly offended by the idea that dragons can be different depending on the source they are from. But for a lot of people, the definition of a dragon is a six-limbed creature, meaning two legs at the front, two legs at the back, and two wings. People who subscribe to this definition of dragons would call a dragon with only four limbs, meaning two legs at the back, and two wings that they also use as sort of grasping claws, similar to a bat. People would call a dragon of that type a wyvern, or something along those lines. They don't classify these as dragons. But I'm here to tell you that I think that all dragons are equal. I am not a member, I am not an active fighter in the Limb Wars. I do not think that they are a productive conversation. And so I'm going to give an example of a dragon that does have four limbs. They are real dragons, because they are called real dragons in the source they are from. And that source is A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones. So, in this series, we have dragons with four limbs that breathe fire. So they're classic in that sense. But they sort of have a very interesting history attached to them. Dragons were tamed and used by the House Targaryen, which is sort of the old ruling house of Westeros. They used dragons to conquer all of the kingdoms of that land and held power through their dragons and through their military might for a very long time. But before they moved to Westeros, the dragons were raised in Valyria, old Valyria, the Valyrian freeholds, as they're called. And here, basically, this was a land of marvelous engineering and magic and blacksmithing and culture and architecture and all of that until the Doom of Valyria, which is sort of an unclear event similar to the extinction of the dinosaurs. We're not 100% sure what happened over there, but what we do know is that most of the calamity was dangerous enough that a lot of the dragons died, and all of the houses that lived in Valyria, they sort of scattered. Which is the reason, fun fact, why Valyrian steel is so rare in the Game of Thrones universe, is because they do not know how to make it anymore, because that art was lost. Many people think that it is made through a dragon's fire, which is an interesting tidbit. But anyway, once the great houses of Valyria sort of scattered to the winds, eventually the Targaryens traveled west, and they used three dragons, Vhagar, Meraxes, and Balerion the Black Dread, to do so. Their military might probably wasn't better than most of the other houses at the time, but because they had three massive dragons, they made short work of a lot of armies. So Balerion the Black Dread was said to be large enough to swallow a mammoth whole. So think about that as you will. And that's a fun fact about dragons in A Song of Ice and Fire, is given unlimited space and food, they can grow forever. They literally never need to stop growing. Apparently they can die of old age, however, as this did happen to Balerion later on in his life. But that's that. So dragons in this world, four-limbed. I'm sorry if you are a supremacist who does not consider this a dragon, but because George R. R. Martin calls them dragons, I'm going to err on the side of his argument, and I'm going to say that they are dragons. And interestingly enough, the reason why George R. R. Martin decided to go with the four-limb dragons is because originally, while he was writing A Song of Ice and Fire, he did have the six-limbed classic dragon within his story, but he couldn't find an analog or like a mirror for that within the real world. He didn't see any animals with that configuration of limbs, and so to him, it made more sense to have the four-limbed dragons because we see things like bats with that configuration. So, you know, it's just classic nerd stuff where you try to make your fantasy story with dragons in it as realistic and anatomically accurate as possible. So, we have been through the ringer, we've looked at a couple different types of dragons, and here we are. So now we are going to get into the meat and potatoes of this episode, which is how to make dragons interesting, how to sort of shake it up a little bit, how to make them unique and separate from other instances and other incarnations of dragons. So let's jump right into it. So just as we did in the elves episode, we are going to sort of take a couple of common aspects that we found about dragons, and we are going to sort of flip those on their head or explore those more and see what we can come up with. So the first one I want to do is the greediness of dragons. So we don't see this in every case. Like in Game of Thrones, dragons don't even talk, but they don't seem to be overly concerned about wealth. But with things like Smaug and Fafnir, that was an overwhelming character trait. And so the question that came to my mind is, why do dragons need to be aggressive conquerors to steal treasure? If they're so intelligent, I get that, so maybe like the need to take overcomes them. But if they're so intelligent, why does pissing off every mortal race seem like a good idea to them? We know for a fact that humans, in most fantasy instances, that they persevere. You know, they're always going to figure out how to get in there. They're going to kill the dragon eventually. It just takes the right hero or the right plan. And so if the dragons are that smart, they'd say, okay, literally everyone in my family has died from stealing treasure, so maybe I'm going to stop that. And so in my mind, it would be kind of cool to have a setting where the dragons don't need to be aggressive or even overt in their efforts. I'm thinking the James Bond kind of dragon who, like, using magic and their own wits, they figure out and they socially engineer situations that are favorable for them. So maybe they use their wits and their magic to steal the best artifacts from the richest people. Are the dragons in this world small? Are they small enough that they can, like, they're sort of meet, like, I don't know, like larger than a human, but, you know, not Smaug-sized? Are they small enough that they can sneak into places with the cover of night and find ways to steal? Do they have minions and worshippers that they send out on these missions across the land to find the best artifacts, to find the best jewels and bring them back? Or is a dragon capable of masking or disguising their presence? Or even using magic to sort of shift their form into a human? This is something that comes up in Dungeons & Dragons in later editions. The older a dragon gets, the more powerful they become, the more magic they have access to, some dragons, the good dragons specifically, are actually able to change into a humanoid or an animal form, and a lot of times this is how they travel, so as to not draw too much attention to themselves. So it makes sense to me that a dragon could perform the best heist possible if they had access to enough magic, and if they were smart enough, which they're supposed to be. So that's one take on dragons you could try out. How about the intelligence of dragons? That's something we've talked about a lot. It's often expressed that they are intelligent in a way, that their minds work in a way that is sort of hard to understand for other races. And so if you just took that aspect of dragons and turned it up to 100, what would that look like? So to me, I'm thinking a world where dragons engage in solitary research. They have laboratories, not necessarily like a medical lab or something like that, but maybe something like alchemical, or they have like towers where they are constantly tinkering, they are constantly testing out other theories. Because they're so intelligent, they have this need to discover and to understand things. Perhaps that manifests itself through live test subjects. You can go for the more malevolent approach. Or something more benign, where they're discovering how this one spell works, or like, how do you make this potion? Perhaps they're professors and instructors. You know, they live so long that they probably have a vast hoard of knowledge. Perhaps they're like that quirky teacher that everybody loves, but everybody's also afraid of talking to one-on-one. They're hermits and sages in this world, where they are respected for their understanding and feared for their sort of alien intellect. And maybe even if you want, you could take it even farther. You can say that insanity is sort of a defining aspect of dragonkind. Maybe every dragon speaks in riddles. They're never exactly clear on what they mean. And the only one who truly understands a dragon is themselves. And you can twist that in a sort of sad way, where dragons are sort of doomed to live amongst these younger races that are never going to understand them. And so they're doing their best they can to help. But their lives are ultimately lonely and solitary. And so that's another interesting way to sort of take a twist on the dragon. And I think it's also interesting to have dragons that are benevolent and good, and not always just these warmongering evil creatures. And on a similar note, I sort of like the idea of dragons as protectors, wardens, and stewards instead of aggressors. And this can manifest in a lot of ways. But in my own novel, the world of Varantha isn't full of dragons, but they are there. A long time ago, they were created by the Drothi, which are the giants in my world, in a time when chaos was sort of reigned and was chaos was basically everywhere. In this world, dragons are symbols of order. They're constructs of nature and magic that basically fight and combat the changing world by establishing law and control. And this is something that the giants value, but this is not necessarily something that all the races in the land appreciate, because, as we know, a world full of only law and control would be just as grim as a world where chaos was everywhere. And so the dragons can be woken in times of strife when the giants themselves can't really handle or beat back the encroaching chaos. And so the dragons are brought in as sort of their backup. And so they are wardens, but they're not necessarily good aligned, one would say. And I think this idea of dragons as protectors of different things is sort of similar to the dragons in World of Warcraft. They have the dragon aspects, where each different color of dragon sort of guards a different thing. For example, the bronze dragonflight, I think they're like the wardens of time. They sort of make sure that time isn't bothered, basically. You have the green dragonflight, which sort of protects like the natural world and the dream, which is sort of like the place where druidic magic and nature magic spills forth. And so, yeah, you have this idea where dragons are protectors of very specific things made for a certain purpose, and they guard that thing with their life, and that is their only goal in life. And well, folks, that is the episode on dragons. So I would like to leave you off with a very relevant quote this week by the famous fantasy and science fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin. Quote, "People who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons from within." End quote. Thank you once again for listening to The Writer's Sheath. As always, my name is David, and I'll see you next time, wherever the story may take us.